Welcome, gentle listener, to Still Dreaming, an existentialist wandering through our forever night. Thank you, dear listener, for your kind attention to this pointless rambling. This is episode 2. Being re-recorded and re-released with slightly better audio quality than my original recording of episode 2. If you're new to this podcast, welcome. I hope you've listened to the re-recording of episode 1, and that you'll enjoy this one at least as much, and you'll be inspired to go on to episode 3 and move your way through our back catalog to the midpoint of the season, which is where we left off when I had to take my little hiatus. My usual reminder that Forever Night is episodic, but this podcast kind of isn't. So you may be best served starting at the introduction and working your way forward. So with that, thank you, and let's begin, shall we? We continue today with episode 2 of the series, a continuation from last time. This is Dark Knight, the second chapter. It originally aired on May 6, 1992, directed by Alan Croker and James D. Perreault and Barry Cohen. The synopsis, plundered once again from Wikipedia, reads simply this. Nick's search for the Jade Cup leads him to La Croix, and Nick must choose between saving his newfound love's life or learning a ritual that may make him mortal again. Oh, Nick, what's a brooding vampire cop to do? Good evening, gentle listeners. Last we left our brooding hero, he was lost in memories of his past, torn between who he used to be and the self-aware creature that he is now. He was taunted on the radio by the Nightcrawler, La Croix, the vampire who brought him across in the 13th century. Nick and his new partner, Don Skanky, still had not solved the mystery of the vampire-like killings that haunt Toronto's homeless population. Nick thinks the killings are related to the stolen Jade Cup, a Mayan artifact that may hold the key to curing his vampirism. As Nick contemplated his endless parade of nights and what it means for him to be an immortal creature of the night, we contemplated the writings of Albert Camus, notably the myth of Sisyphus. Why is he so damned happy? This episode opens up with Nick's meeting with La Croix. Blues and blacks, the color palette of Forever Night. I'm still loving the look of the show. The color palette and the camera angles, it's just great. Uh-oh, the curator is there. She's following Nick. Why? How? How do these two vampires with super hearing not hear her scuttling up the alleyway behind them? And boy, I never knew Toronto was so foggy. Elsa is right behind Nick as they dramatically parade down the alleyway to a convenient slaughterhouse. I cannot believe that Nick has no clue that she's there. So this warehouse slaughterhouse set is cool. Nice green lighting introduced into the color palette. I wonder, though, aren't they in the city? Are there just meat packing plants with hanging pig carcasses and barrels of blood in the middle of the city? I mean, I've been to Canada, but never Toronto. Anyway, it's cool looking. Metal, diagonal angles, gloomy lighting. It looks like the kind of place I'd like to listen to Nine Inch Nails and take black and white photographs when I was 16 years old. So the confrontation begins. Tilted camera angles and shadows tell us that Lacroix is the bad guy, as though his haircut didn't tell us that already. "I moved here especially for you," Lacroix says. He's been seeking Nick out. "Immortality," Lacroix says. "I gave that to you. We need to trust each other," he says. "You can't deny what you are." Nick, a vampire in the 20th century, stands before his maker, confronted with a choice. Embrace what he is, or continue to seek his fool's quest. Nicholas, disillusioned with life in the 13th century, seeks a greater purpose, immortality, with Jeanette and Lacroix. Instead of escaping the human condition, the imminence of death, he finds the true condition of humanity, lack of meaning, the absurd. He is consigned to the life of an animal, a creature hunting and feeding with no promise of relief from the cycle. He seeks mortality again because mortality gives the promise of death, completion, and possibly meaning. Becoming a vampire didn't elevate him above humanity, it made him the ultimate human, consigned to an endless life of repetitive motions, fleeting friendships, empty motions, and endless parade of nights. Nick is self-aware enough to be saddened by the burden of the rock he pushes up the hill, but he gains no peace in watching it tumble back down again. But what about Lacroix? Is he our metaphorical Sisyphus? No. He's also living a delusion. He thinks himself a king, but he's only the alpha dog of a small pack of wandering mongrels. "Humans all have to die," he tells Nick. "What does it matter if it's sooner or later?" Lacroix embraces his savage violence. It's his source of power. He's deluded in his sense of grandeur. But feeling like a king doesn't make it so. Nick sees the emperor has no clothes, but how to escape the empire of forever night? You can't deny what you are. Lacroix threatens to kill Nick, with all the ease and flippancy of a good villain. He thoughtfully establishes the rules for vampires in this universe for the audience. What can kill them, and so on. In the struggle, Elise is threatened, but saved by Nick, and the jade cup is smashed, and Lacroix is staked through the heart with a metal rail. "I made you a god. I made you my brother," Lacroix says. "I shall repay you," replies Nick. Lacroix is dead. "Uh-huh. Yep. He sure is dead, all right. I totally believe that Lacroix is totally, completely dead." Anyway, suddenly it's daytime and Elise is long gone. Nick stumbles to his car, smoke billowing out from under his clothes, as he makes his way to the caddy, pops the trunk, and jumps in. Nick's trunk has the blue lighting, too. Nice feature. Camus' Sisyphus asks, "Why should I not kill myself?" In his work, The Rebel, Camus asks, "Why should I not kill others?" Ultimately, these are the two main questions at the core of Forever Night. Why should Nick reject his vampirism and stop killing humans? Why shouldn't he just let himself be consumed by the sun, sacrificing himself and securing final release from his struggle? Nick is a believer in something. An afterlife, the concept of salvation, the promise of absolution. His cursed condition marks him as a creature of sin and selfishness who kills to sustain and entertain, who, if he embraced his nature the way Lacroix has, could be completely stripped of humanity and compassion. For whatever reason, Nick still has compassion, still has hope. This is what damns him. Wisdom, Camus writes in Nuptials, is in, quote, conscious certainty of death without hope, end quote. Nothing in this world matters except the right now, the right here, the immediacy of the present. Nick constantly yearns for an impossible transcendent future while chained to the events of his past. Until Nick can find peace in the absurdity of the now, there will never be peace for him. Camus writes that, quote, hope is disastrous for humans insomuch as it leads them to minimize the value of this life except as preparation for a life beyond. Nick's hope for salvation is precisely what damns him. His current quest for mortality is a deference, a way of not negotiating the present, not accepting his current state. He pushes his rock up the hill angrily, already knowing it will fall and already hating it for doing so, and therefore not feeling the life in his veins, probably a bad metaphor, the present pleasures of the struggle, the endless possibility of the right now. When I first had this thought, it was a bit of a revelation and completely changed how I decided to think about Forever Night. I now see this series as a commentary on existentialism and the absurd, using the metaphor of vampirism to illustrate how people lose sight of the beautiful importance of the current moment in their struggle to overcome a past that doesn't exist anymore, or to get a better position in a future that doesn't yet exist. I may be the only person who thinks this, but there it is. Nick is hiding from the sun in the trunk of his car. There is a metaphor in there somewhere. He's been gone so long, his car has been towed to the station, and Skanky is going to drive it because he wants to. I mean, Skanky's just got a semi over this car, but I notice no real concern at all for the still-missing Nick. He just wants to joyride. Skanky drives the caddy to the hospital to follow up on some leads on the murders. Nick comes to in the trunk and hops out and snoops around the doctor's computer while Skanky is at the nurse's station. Nick is totally comfortable using a computer database on a machine that isn't his and presumably he hasn't been trained on in 1992. Is Nick a Mary Sue? Am I using that term correctly? Back at the car, the murderer tampers with the brakes. Nick is back in the trunk. Skanky starts driving. He's listening to polka music, because he's Polish. You get it? The polka music makes Nick writhe in agony, and I laugh, because I feel his pain. So this is the exciting action moment of the episode. Hang on, and don't blink, or you'll miss it. The brakes are failing. Skanky is careening out of control, whipping the caddy across lanes, overdubbed horns blaring and screeching tire sounds as Nick is tossed around in the trunk, cut to commercial. Back from commercial, and apparently the writers forgot that they were supposed to resolve that tension because it is anticlimactic as fuck. At the police garage, Skanky, who still doesn't know where Nick is, or if he's in trouble or not, is only concerned with how much it's going to cost to fix the Cadillac. Nick finds the perfect time when no one's around to pop out of the car. He sort of gets fake mad at Skanky, but then they realize Skanky's theory about the murderer was right all along, and now they're buddies. Still no concern over where Nick was the whole time. You know what? That's efficient storytelling. Love it. The crash part I didn't love, it was kind of lame, honestly. To emphasize, our police detective, Don Skanky, never once asks where Nick has been or how he got back to the station. Nick has not done any vampire mind trick on him yet. Yeah, guys, Donnie is not a good dick. So Elise is at Nick's apartment. She knows how to get the code to get in his door, which confused me the first time I saw this. But then I remembered Nick had said his code was from the Mayan hieroglyphics, and later we saw Hunter deciphering them to get the code. So, okay, good setup and payoff there, even if it was a bit convoluted. So she's stalking him, apparently. She knows he's a vampire at this point. She saw him with Lacroix, and Lacroix almost killed her. She finds one of the murderer's victims still alive and calls the hospital. But, gasp! It's the murderer coming, and not the ambulance. And I'm skipping a lot of details here because I'm sure you get a pretty good idea of what's going to happen here, don't you? I do want to pause to reflect on the 1980s and 1990s TV trope of the answering machine. What a great dramatic device. Our characters can just miss important information by leaving home or the office just before the important call comes, but can get access to the message by calling the machine later in the episode so that they know what they need to know before the final commercial break. And that's what happens. Nick and Skanky figure out who the killer is. Nick decides it's a great time to check his messages before they go and look for the bad guy. Elise, who's in Nick's apartment, hears Nick access his machine and picks up the phone, allowing Nick to hear exactly when the killer arrives and attacks. Very convenient. Nick scrambles, yelling at Skanky to take the car, and he dashes out the door. Skanky yells, "How you gonna get there? Fly?" Nick is not good at hiding that he's a vampire. Skanky's not good at detectiving. So we're back at the apartment. The killer is nuts, like super, totally bozo nuts. Apparently, he's totally normal at work, but right now, he is nuttier than a fruitcake. Struggle, fight, fight, struggle. Elise is thrown to the side. The homeless girl who was his victim, she wakes up and fends off the killer with fire, and now, whoa, Nick's loft is on fire. Does this ever come up again? Like, will there be fire and smoke damage in his place in episode 3? I'll have to remember to look for that. Spoiler alert from the future. No, there isn't. And so Lacroix is there. Is he going to save the day? I mean, wouldn't that be great? So, did the death at the beginning of the episode fool anyone? After Lacroix made a point of saying that a wooden stake through the heart kills a vampire, and then he's run through with a metal stake, did anyone really think Lacroix was for reals dead? It's hard for me to imagine anyone was falling for that. Nick and Lacroix scuffle. The flames grow. Nick and Elise are trapped by the fire. Nick is weak because he hasn't fed on blood in a long time, and Elise makes an offer. "Take me," she says. For fuck's sake. "Take me." Oh, God. I did a facepalm when that happened. "Take me. I want to live forever." Ugh, gross. Lacroix chimes in, "Mortals die. What does it matter how or when?" And Jesus, this is a long conversation to have in a literal burning house. So anyway, what you think is going to happen, happens. Nick looks like he might give in, but of course he does not. He leaps through the flames. Lacroix bites Elise, and then Nick stabs Lacroix through with a burning stake like a fucking boss. And this time, Lacroix is engulfed in flames and eventually crumbles into a pile of burning goth clothes. Toast. So spoilers, I guess. Lacroix comes back. But how are they going to explain this? This is going to be interesting because he's fucking dead, destroyed. How does he come back from that? We won't find out tonight because it's wrap-up time. And this ending feels quick, rushed. They're back at the museum. The remaining cup is returned. There's some dialogue about what happened to people off-screen. It's all fairly flat. This is to reset at the end of the episode. We're moving on. Nick and Nat are there, and they still have that chemistry I love so much from the first episode. She talks about trying to help him with his condition. He makes a comment about never being able to be in love? Jeez, fuck, Nick. Twist a knife. Then suddenly, he gets really handsy and playful with Nat. I mean, given everything he's just said. He's morose and sorrowful over the loss of his chance at humanity one second, and then all flirty and touchy with Nat the next. Natalie in the scene is Dr. Exposition. She gives us the thesis statement of the show, practically. She, Nick, and Skanky leave to jazzy sax music. But surprise, Elise is there, and she's a vampire! Fuck! Does she ever come back? Well, spoilers, no. Alright, so it's a wonderful, low-budget, quick wrap-up on this ending. It is rather anticlimactic. So TV cliché. Boy, that sure was exciting when the thing happened off-screen that provided the resolution to the problem we were facing. Too bad that chick totally died in your apartment. Ha ha ha, vampire joke. Let's get Slovaki. Skanky's Polish. Get it? It's so bad. And fuck, I love it. But I'm tickled by it now, because Forever Night is this thing I've mythologized, and it's meaningful to me in a way I can't fully articulate. And now I see it for all its cheesy, cliché glory, and I'm still enjoying the sugar rush. But can this high maintain me over the next 68 episodes? Who's going to bring down this sweet high? Camus, that's who. So before we ask the question, why is Sisyphus happy? Sisyphus's labor is a triumph. Sisyphus hates death, has passion for life in accepting its absurdity. Sisyphus is at his strongest when he watches the boulder tumble down and then trots along after it. He has what's called tragic consciousness. He is living fully aware of the bitterness of our being and consciously facing our fate. Sisyphus lives out what has been imposed on him, making it his own. Quote, happiness and the absurd are two sons of the same earth. They are inseparable, end quote. This is what Camus writes in his works. We are fully alive when we embrace the struggle in spite of or because of its futility. One must imagine Sisyphus happy. So here we are, at the end of this re-recording of episode 2 of Still Dreaming. Looking back on this experience so far, I really do love this show, and I really do enjoy doing this podcast. I'm sad I've had to take such a long time away from it, and I hope that these re-recorded first two episodes help make up for the absence in some small way. I really do like the first two episodes of Forever Night. There were parts of it that definitely show its age and its lack of budget. Early 90s TV writing stands out, especially at the end. Overall, though, it's a real treat. It's nice to get to know Nick again, and it brought a smile to my face to see Jeanette even briefly, and Skanky, even though he was a jerk for most of it. Natalie is definitely the highlight of these first two episodes, although she was barely in part two and served mainly as exposition delivery. I still love the actress's delivery and her chemistry with Nick. So, if you're new to the podcast, I hope you will continue listening, starting with episode 3 and moving your way towards the midpoint of the season. Maybe by the time you get there, if you don't binge too quickly, I'll have a few more new episodes up. I'm not going to tamper too much with the format of the show. I'm going to keep it basically like this. Although if you have suggestions on things you'd like to see me change or alter in the format, I'm certainly open to suggestions. So, you know, definitely let me know. As the beginning of the series, this two-part premiere sets up a lot of promise. There's a lot here to dive into with the characters. Episode 3 of Forever Night is entitled, For I Have Sinned, and if you haven't listened to it before, I hope you check it out. Until next time, gentle listener, I hope you'll return again to Still Dreaming, our existentialist wandering through our forever night. Do you want to connect with Still Dreaming? You can find us on Instagram at Still Dreaming Podcast and on Twitter at podcast_still. And we have a group on Facebook. Just look up Still Dreaming Podcast. Would you like to help support the show? Donation buttons can be found on our website, stilldreamingpodcast.wordpress.com. Let's pause for a word from our sponsor. Still Dreaming is a podcast hosted and recorded by me in the newly revamped CERK Internet Radio Studio. Forever Night was produced for CBS by Glenn Warren Productions and Sony Pictures Television. All rights reserved.